experience with tapeworms. Any GP would. They were a common enough affliction. A person could pick them up anywhere. As easy as petting your dog, providing your dog had rolled in a pile of shit earlier that day, as dogs tend to do, you could get microscopic particles of said shit on your fingers without even knowing. 1,000 eggs stuck between the whorls of your fingertips. And after petting old Spot, let's say you ate a handful of popcorn and licked the salt off your fingers, bingo, bango, bongo, you've got worms. At least once a month, he'd see a kid in the waiting room scratching his keister through the seat of his pants and say to himself, worms. One time a kid's mother handed him an ice cream tub with one of her child's chalky turds inside. I thought you'd want a sample, she'd told him solemnly, for proof. Tim would prescribe an oral remedy that demolished the tapeworm colony over a few days. Tapeworms were at most a nuisance. He's dead, Tim said simply. Ephraim said, from worms? No, Eph, from a worm. Kent said, how the hell can a tapeworm kill someone? I had worms when I was 8. I crapped the little buggers out. I know, Tim said. I gave your mother the medicine to do it. This one wasn't the size of any regular worm, Tim thought. He'd heard that beef tapeworms, the ones you can get from eating tainted meat, could get pretty big, 20-30 feet. He recalled a case study where a doctor pulled one out of a cattle rancher's leg. It had balled up between the layers of muscle, a lump the size of a baseball. The doctor made a slit into the muscle and pulled it out of the rancher's leg like teasing out a piece of thread. The worm was incredibly skinny, like a strand of angel hair pasta. It snapped. The rest of the worm died inside the muscle and started to rot. The rancher almost lost his leg. But even so, the longest worms weren't really that thick. Ephraim said, what did it do to him? What could Tim tell them? The truth? The truth, which even he wanted to avoid, was that the tapeworm had done what tapeworms do, eaten everything the man was supposed to eat, like having a furnace turned up to full blast inside of you. Everything you throw into it, it burns up. No fuel left for you. Tim thought about the blood-leached whiteness of the man's flesh and realized the worm may have consumed other things, too. His blood and enzymes. That would have shut down his kidneys and liver and other organs. Some kind of vampire. But he couldn't say this. It would terrify the boys. And yet he'd nearly told them anyway. Sharing the terror seemed like the only way to diffuse it, even minimally. But they were just kids. Even now, with the mainland and hospitals and help seeming so far away, Tim understood his obligation to these boys and to their parents. He must keep them safe. Scout's honor. Are you okay? Newton asked. You and Max, did anything, you know, touch you? The boys stared at Tim, all probably wondering the same thing. Now in the aftermath, Tim wondered why he'd done it. Not the operation itself, but involving Max. He told himself that he needed help. No surgeon operates alone. But now he was less sure. Tim, Kent said, his eyes holding a rook's sheen, did anything touch you? Fuck off, you pushy bastard, the undervoice spat. I don't think so, Tim said. It happened very fast. Kent turned to Max. You okay, man? Max nodded, eyes not leaving the ground. When Tim saw this, a cold, hard stone lodged somewhere in his diaphragm. You made a mistake, Tim, Hal 9000 said. Don't go compounding it. What happened? Ephraim said. Tell us. Tim nibbled his lip compulsively, as if his unconscious desire was to consume his own flesh. He caught himself, smiled queasily. His eyes shone in the firelight, hubbed by skin drawn tight over his sockets, and said, I cut into the man's stomach. The worm was in there, nesting. It came out through the incision. It crawled up the man's chest and wrapped around his neck. Couldn't stop swallowing. Killed him. You cut him up? Kent asked, incredulous. I told you it happened so fast. Tim's mouth was a dry wick, his spit all dried up. It was like something out of a dream. Amazing, said Kent. The sneering derision was unmistakable. He sounded very much like his policeman father. I was scared, Tim said. It came out as a whisper. He observed the boys' faces clustered round the fire, all wearing matching looks of diminished respect, and wished he could take those honest words back. Yeah, well, this is no time to be scared, Tim, Kent said. Tim wanted to slap the mouthy little prick across the face, but his strength had utterly deserted him. Mosquitoes jigged around their heads. Why aren't they landing on me? Tim wondered. His hands were clean, yet they still felt sticky with goo. He felt it in the creases of his fingers, in his nail beds, an antic, wriggling itch. He closed his eyes and envisioned that goo drooling out of the worm's cleaved body. The firelight glowed against his eyelids, lighting up the capillaries that braided under his skin. So it's dead? Newton said. Max nodded. Scoutmaster Tim cut it in half. It was effectively dead before that, Tim said. Once the host is dead, the parasite dies too. Why would it do that? Newton asked. Wrap around the man's neck and kill him. It's like a baby strangling its mom or something. Tim gave a helpless shrug. Worms don't have brains to speak of. Worms shouldn't grow to that size, but that's what happened. We saw it. You've got to trust the evidence of your eyes. Newton said, Do we even know the guy's name? His words fell like an anvil. Suddenly the man's name seemed critical. The idea of a man dying as a stranger surrounded by other strangers struck the boys as staggeringly tragic. I want to go home, Shelley said softly. Take us home, Scoutmaster, please. In the firelight, Shelley's face molded into a beseeching expression. Mock beseeching? The expression rang hollow, inorganic, and somehow clumsy, like an animal trying to replicate human endeavor, a bear riding a bicycle, or a monkey playing a milk carton ukulele. In Tim's fevered mind, it seemed like the boy was purposely stirring fear within the group by asking for something beyond Tim's capacity to deliver. Tomorrow, Shelley, we can leave. Why not tonight, Tim? Shelley said, adopting Kent's derisive tone. Why can't you get us home tonight? Because I'm too fucking tired, you awful little shit. Tired and hungry as hell. Tomorrow, I promise. Shelley stared at Tim. There was something insectile about his gaze. The wind gusted, blowing the flames slantways, and in that instant, Tim watched Shelley's face liquefy like hot wax, the skin running, bones shifting and grinding like tectonic plates to arrange themselves into something infinitely more horrifying. Kent said, I want to see it. Tim said, It? The worm, Tim. I want to see the worm. No. Kent gave his scoutmaster a sidelong look, eyeing him down to his hawk-like nose the way a sniper stares down a rifle's sights. Without another word, Kent stood and strode off toward the cabin. Tim was dismayed to find he lacked the voice to stop him. Evidence log, case 518C, piece A13, personal effects, lab journal of Dr. Clive Edgerton. Recovered from Site A, 220 Makepeace Road, Summerside, Prince Edward Island, by Officer Brian Scully, Badge 908. Pages 122 to 126. Test Subject 4, Beta Series. Guinea Pig. Zoologics Incorporated, Breeding Batch EE-76-2. Subject's pretest weight, 1,350 grams. Date, 7/19. 7 o'clock. Introduced modified hydatid, genetic recombination M3-11, via injection. Between 100 and 250 post-embryonic stage eggs delivered via liposome vehicle. Subject is alert and energetic. Eyes are clear, evidencing no overt signs of distress or pain. 8 o'clock. Subject unchanged. 9 o'clock. Subject unchanged. 10 o'clock. Subject unchanged. 10:13. Subject emits series of squeals. 10:47. Subject appears disoriented, bumping into bars of its enclosure, emitting distressed squeals at a significantly higher pitch and with increased frequency. 11:07. Subject is observed chewing bars of its enclosure. 11:09. Subject is observed consuming cedar shavings lining its enclosure. 11:15. Subject is observed consuming own fecal matter. 11:22. Sizable evacuation of larval stage hydatid via excretory tract. 11:41. Subject emits squeals reaching a prolonged high pitch before ceasing. Post-test note. Subject vocalization cease at this point. 11:56. Subject is observed consuming portion of left front paw. Eyes glazed. Breathing rapid. Overall body torpor. Subject appears either unaware of its actions or beyond pain. Bleeding is minimal. 12:03. First gastrointestinal rupture observed. Occurs along transmedial cleft. Fissure observed to be 1/8 of an inch. Quantity of adolescent stage hydatid worms observed exiting the subject's body. 12:08. Subject exhibiting signs of late-stage morbidity. Noticeable stiffening of joints, labored breathing, milky film developing on eyes. Subject's mouth opening and closing repeatedly. Appears to be chewing on the air. 12:16. Second gastrointestinal rupture observed, 1/2 inch below original fissure. Large quantity of adolescent stage hydatid worms observed extruding from subject's stomach cavity. 12:19. Subject host deceased. 12:22. Remaining hydatids deceased. Test concludes. Test duration, 5 hours 22 minutes. Subject's post-test weight, 490 grams. Total weight loss, 860 grams. Chapter 15. 15 minutes later, Scoutmaster Tim would be locked and shivering inside the cabin's utility closet. It would be Kent's idea. He would suggest that the boys lock their Scoutmaster up for a rational reason, but ultimately he would do it simply because he could. There was something thrilling about leading the others in such an enormous act of rebellion. Kent set off from the fire at a determined clip. He figured that Tim may try to stop him, but more and more it seemed he lacked the resolve. Tim was scared. He said so, practically blubbering his guts out around the fire. Kent wasn't scared, though. Hell no. It wasn't any part of his character. They needed a proper leader right now, not a big old fraidy cat. The other boys would follow. Kent was positive. All it required was for him to take that first step. Who the hell was Tim, anyway? In the view of Kent's father, Mr. Timothy Riggs was a lonely, middle-aged fairy. Not a pedo. Jeff Jenks would cut his own balls off before he'd leave his kids in the woods with one of those. No, according to Big Jeff, Tim Riggs was probably just a willowy, sorrowful queer who lived alone in his big house on the bluffs. You got every right to see what's inside that cabin, son. Every legal right, Kent heard his father saying. Don't let this noodle-wristed flamer make that decision for you. Not now, with the stakes this high. Don't you see what he's done? The quacks cut open a complete stranger. Gutted him. Field-dressed the poor bastard like a 5-point buck. He's admitted as much, and now he wants to cover up his act. A man is dead, son. It's up to you to get this under control. What, Tim's gonna stop you? Listen, Kent, it's a total mess in there, Max said from behind. I mean, a dead guy. No joke. Why the hell do you want to see it so bad? I want to see it, too, came Shelley's voice from someplace in the dark. Kent laid his hands on Max's shoulders the same way his father did when one of his deputies got a case of the jitters. Max, I need to see, okay? If I don't see what the problem is, how can you expect me to deal with it? Max's brow furrowed. Yeah, but nothing. We have every right. Okay, but you better put gauze over your mouth and eyes. Why? Infection. Kent nodded somberly. Yeah, good thinking. Tim had nearly caught up. Kent heard his labored breathing like a sick Pekingese. Kent Jenks, if you set one foot inside that... Kent shouldered his way through the door. The smell hit him like a ball-peen hammer. Sweet, fruity top notes, rancid decay lurking underneath. The man lay on the Chesterfield with his wrists and ankles bound. His shirt was slashed open, his white flesh glazed with sludge. He would look almost peaceful if not for those skinned-back lips setting his mouth in a horrible leer. He looked like a man holding a carnal secret. A segment of the worm lay on the floor. To Kent, it looked like a much bigger version of the condom he and Charlie Swanson had once found under the football bleachers at Montague High. Charlie had poked the condom with a stick. Sluggish late summer flies took flight, their drone thick in Kent's ears. What is that? He'd said. Charlie said, you've never seen a Dahmer? You put it over your wick before you screw a chick so you don't get her preggers. Charlie had two older brothers. He knew things. Kent remembered feeling vaguely ashamed of his innocence. Also a little sick. But the sight of the man stunned him now. He was dead. Maybe Kent had expected it to be like his grandmother's funeral, grandma lying peacefully in a mahogany coffin in the beige parlor while a pianist played Nearer My God to Thee, serene with her eyes closed and her cheeks gently rouged. This man was graceless in death. A ring of purple bruises encircling his neck, a brown shit-like mess leaking out of his side, one eye wide open, the other at half-mast like he was tipping a dirty wink. Fruit flies shimmering over his wound to drink the sweet filth. The man had died unloved and without dignity. Kent wished he could act as his father would have right now. He'd cordon off the area and call for a forensic appraisal. He'd grab a bullhorn and calmly say, "Disperse, people. Nothing to see here." But that wasn't true, was it? Jesus, there was everything to see here. Fear stole into Kent's heart like a safecracker. It embarrassed him. He'd pushed for this outcome, hadn't he? But right then he wanted to take it all back. He wished he were on the mainland, safe in his bed with his Labrador retriever, Argo, sleeping soundly beside him. He wished for that with every atom of his body. Tim plowed through the throng of boys, splashing rubbing alcohol on the fronts of their shirts. Pull them over your mouth and nose. Hey, do it. Now! The boys obeyed. Their gazes were fogged with shock above their pulled-up collars. All except Shelley's, whose eyes held an excitable, glittery quality. Tim shoved Kent, both hands planted in the boy's chest. Kent went down so hard his ass bounced off the floor. I told you to goddamn well stay out of here, didn't I, Kent? Tim hunched over the fallen boy. He grabbed his shoulder roughly and shook him. Kent's body ragdolled in his grip. This is the site of a disease. Now you all run the risk of infection. Tim ran his hands through his hair, which stood up in smoke and sweat-hardened spikes. His mouth hung open like a panting dog's, the flesh drawn tight over his cheekbones. You're acting irrational, Tim, HAL 9000 said coolly. You've harmed a child now, and is it really the first time you've harmed a child tonight? Worms spread by contact, he said, ignoring that voice. Do you understand? If you eat something full of worms or worms' eggs, then you get worms. There's nothing for you to do, Kent. There's nothing to be fucking fixed. If your dad, the mighty Jeff Jenks, tried his dick-swinging act here, he'd end up just like that guy over there, okay? Tim pictured Jenks the senior, his blue uniform stretched over his gut. Buttons taxed to their tensile limit, hairy knuckled hands hooked through his belt loops as he surveyed the scene with a caustic eye. Wellsy, 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 Doc, what's the rhubarb here? Don't you talk about my dad like that, Kent said weakly. Shut up! Tim slumped heavily at the kitchen table. Just shut up! I mean it, Kent. If you pull any more shit, I will truss you up like a Christmas turkey. Do you know one goddamn thing about contagion, any of you? We don't know what we're dealing with here. Could be orally born. Could be waterborne. Jesus, it could be airborne. Then why cut him open? Shelley said, covering his mouth so his words were muffled by his fingers. Why drag Max into it? Or us? Tim looked from boy to boy to boy, seeing nothing he could recognize anymore, only disdain and suspicion and slowly kindling rage. That trust he'd worked so hard to build up, an undertaking of many years, had worn down to a brittle strand. The possibility that it could snap at any moment left him paralyzed with fear. He pointed to the cleaved segment of worm on the floor. That is like nothing in nature, boys. Do you understand me? These things should not exist. It's nothing God ever made, so we have to be incredibly careful. We have to step very lightly. We should burn down the cabin, Shelley mumbled. Tim shook his head. That could just put the contagion into the air. What we are going to do is this. Go outside. Sit by the fire. Tim worried the ragged edge off one fingernail with his incisors and swallowed it convulsively. We'll wait for the boat to come the day after tomorrow. That's all we can do. The fixed drone of a helicopter worked its way across the open water. It seemed to hover directly above them. Coin-bright wedges of light, the glow of a searchlight, shafted through apertures in the roof. The helicopter's wings sent gusts of sea-scented air through the gaps in the cabin's log walls. The light dimmed abruptly as the helicopter continued out to sea. Will the boat even come, Scoutmaster Tim? Newton asked. Of course. We'll all go home. Your parents will be thrilled to see you. They'll send a research team out. Now, come on. Let's go on out. Outside. A wave of dizziness rocked the Scoutmaster. Gnat-like specks crowded his vision, his sinuses burnt with ozone, the same eye-watering sensation as if he'd jumped off the dock into the bay and salt water rocketed up his nose. He licked his thread-like lips. We have to. Kent hauled himself up. His eyes reflected a horrible awareness. You're sick, he said in a trembling voice. You're infected. You've got the worms. I don't. A childlike sick feeling hived in Tim's stomach, as if he'd eaten too much cotton candy at the Abbotsford Carnival and gone on the tilt-a-whirl. It's important that we... We have to quarantine him, Kent said to the others. He could make us all sick, like him. Kent advanced with a determined gait. Tim held his arms out. Jesus! A pair of fleshy javelins. He pushed the boy. His hands sunk harmlessly into the boy's chest as Kent's shoulders sagged to dampen the impact. Tim stumbled away on legs that felt like wooden stilts screwed into his hips. Please, he said. He pushed again kittenishly. Kent was smiling now. It was not a kind look. This transgression had been building in Kent. It enfolded him with a cold sense of assurance. He was right to act against his elder. If you exerted your will and held fast to that course of action, things inevitably worked out. All the gifts that came to you, gifts befitting your inflexible strength of character, would be rightfully earned. He pushed his scoutmaster. Tim fell comically, arms outstretched and mouth open like a fish in its dying gasp. He hit the floor with a spine-jangling thud. His intestines jogged in the loosening vault of his gut. He did a very natural, but terribly unfortunate thing. Tim passed gas, a reedy trumpeting note that daggered through the shocked silence. A ripe reek wafted through the room. I'm sorry, Tim said. I don't. Shelley snickered. You stink. Kent pinned Tim with his rifle sights look. Lock him in the closet. No. Tim said, the word escaping his mouth as a sob. The boys were held in a dimple of tension. Many possibilities tiptoed along the edge of that moment. Next, they were upon him. Shelley went first. Kent followed. They surged down upon their scoutmaster, leapt on him, screaming and garbling. Ephraim next, then Max, with a low, agonized moan. They were filled with a giddy exuberance. All of them felt it, even Newton, who came last, regretfully mumbling, "No, no, no," even as he fell into the fray, unable to fight the queasy momentum. They were carried away on a wave of thick, urgent, blind desire. It happened so swiftly. The pressure that had been building since last night, collecting in drips and drabs, in the crunch of the radio shattering, in the squeal of feedback, in the black helicopter hovering high above them, in the snake ball squirming in the wet rocks, in the sounds emanating from the cabin as Tim and Max operated on the man, and most of all, in the horrifying decline of their scoutmaster, a man they'd known nearly all their lives, reduced to a human anatomy chart, a herky-jerky skeleton. It brewed within them, a throbbing tension in their chests that required release, somehow, by any means necessary, and now, like a dark cloud splitting with rain, it vented. The boys couldn't fight it. They weren't properly themselves. They were a mob, and the mob ruled. "It's just a game," a few of the boys thought. It was a game as long as they could ignore the look of sick terror in their scoutmaster's eyes, the helpless fear of an adult, which ultimately looked not much different than the helpless fear of an infant. It was a game as long as they could ignore the dead man on the Chesterfield leaking brown muck. A game. A game. A game. They dragged Tim to the closet. He unleashed a series of shrill, yipping shrieks. He was terrified of forfeiting control, of how fast it had happened. Terrified of that closet. But mostly he was terrified of whatever might very well be inside of him. "Please, boys," he whimpered. "Please, no. I need help." They would not listen. The wave reached its mad crest. They pulled the scoutmaster with ease. With his weight distributed among the five boys, he weighed no more than a child. Ephraim's hand slipped under Tim's shirt. He felt the abrupt cliff where the flesh fell off his lowest rib. His body was divoted and warped. Ephraim's hands fell upon Tim's stomach. He reared back, shocked by the fretful lashings that met his fingers. Shelley's lips skinned back from his teeth. He looked like a hyena prowling among the corpses on a battlefield. Kent flung the closet door open. It was empty save a few jangling coat hangers. They barrel-rolled Tim inside. The scoutmaster's quivering fingers stuck out through the door jamb. Ephraim gently folded them into the darkness of the closet. They set their weight against the door. Their breath came out in jagged gusts. Kent dashed into the bedroom, returning with a combination lock. He fastened it through the lock hasp and clipped it shut. The boys came back to themselves with a jolt. Max and Ephraim passed nervous, unsmiling looks. Their scoutmaster's whimpers carried under the door.
"When do we let him out?" Newton said.
"When the boat gets here," Kent said coldly. "No sooner."
"What if it doesn't show up?"
Kent said, "Shut up, Newt." Nobody bothered asking for the combination. They knew Kent wouldn't tell them. The bottle of scotch stood uncapped on the table. A man's drink. "General George Patton drank a shot of cheap scotch before battle," Kent's dad always said, "and a glass of good scotch after a victory." What was this, if not a victory? When the boat arrived tomorrow, his quick thinking would be hailed.
"Go on, Kent," Shelley told him. "Have a drink."
Max said, "No, don't." But Kent had already raised the bottle to his lips. It went down like molten iron. He sawed his arm across his mouth. His grimace became a broad grin.
"Everything's going to be okay, guys."
From the sworn testimony of Nathan Erickson, given before the Federal Investigatory Board in connection with the events occurring on Falstaff Island, Prince Edward Island. Question. Mr. Erickson, state how you came to be associated with Dr. Clive Edgerton. Answer. I was just out of school. A few guys who graduated with me caught on as associate profs, but they were the creme de la creme.
I was more like the flotsam.
Question. At loose ends?
Answer.
You could say so. Not a lot of companies have much use for a theoretical molecular biologist whose doctoral dissertation was the human aging process as relating to the C. elegans worm.
Question. C. elegans worm?
Answer. It's a round worm, about a millimeter long. Caenorhabditis elegans, but everyone just calls it C. elegans. During its lifetime, it exhibits many familiar signs of human aging, reduced movement, wrinkling, tissue degradation, decreased ability to fight infection. I was trying to locate genes that might slow down the human aging process.
Question. A noble ambition.
Answer. Yeah, well, I was blinded by science.
Question. How did Edgerton know of you?
Answer. A lot of researchers sniffed around the program, right? They figured they could poach a recent grad, someone to do the scut work.
Question. So Edgerton sought you out?
Answer. It was more a situation of mutual desperation.
Question. What drew him to you?
Answer. Like I said, the fact that I came cheap and didn't have any other options. But I had done work with the C. elegans worm, which bears about the same similarity to the hydatid as a minnow does to a great white shark, and neither creature is anything like what Edgerton bred.
Question. He bred. Didn't you both work on the mutated specimen?
Answer.
Listen, I'll always carry the guilt. I could tell you that the outcome was unknown, that I was pursuing science, and if I'd had an inkling of what was to come, I'd have burned that lab to cinders. After all this is over, you'll send me to prison. I deserve that. Deserve more. But for some crimes, there exists no fit punishment. I was part of it, but I was the lesser part on every level.
Question. How so?
Answer.
Clive Edgerton is a genius. He's also rat-shit crazy, pardon my French, possibly a sociopath, but undoubtedly a genius. Even though my IQ is likely higher than most people's in this room, I was no more than Clive's lab monkey. I can't see the biological processes the way he does. Can't see the chains in order to break and reorder them. So I knew what we were doing, yes, theoretically, anyway, but I didn't create any of it. I can't.
Question.
But you knew?
Answer.
Yes.
Question.
And you told nobody?
Answer.
That's right.
Question.
Why?
Answer.
Trade secrets. We were working on something that, if successful, would have been a billion-dollar enterprise. Edgerton was working under a grant from a biopharmaceutical company. Secrecy was crucial.
Question. So crucial that you'd risk lives?
Answer. We didn't know lives were at... We're talking about one of the three holy grails of modern medicine, a cure for male pattern baldness, a method to reverse the aging process, and a means to lose weight without effort. If anyone invents a pill that you can pop in at night and wake up with a fuller head of hair, or the crow's feet diminished around your eyes, or 5 pounds lighter, there's no saying how much that could be worth. Clive used to cite that old motto, "You can never be too rich or too thin," he'd say. If I can make the rich thin, they'll make me rich.
Chapter 16. Toward midnight, Max stood down by the shore. The sky was salted with remote stars. The beach was a bone-like strip unfurling to the shoreline. The sea advanced up the shore with a series of minute sucking inhales. It sounded like a huge toothless creature swallowing the island. Newton joined him. His hand thrummed against Max's bare arm. His fear leapt the threshold between their bodies. Max felt it now, too.
We shouldn't have done that to the Scoutmaster.
He's sick, Newt.
I saw that, but not a closet. Am I wrong? Not that way.
You did it, too, Max said tiredly. Newton swallowed and nodded.
I did. It could have been what my mom calls a coping mechanism. You know, when things get rough, we do things to make it better. Or just to distract ourselves. Do you think that's what it was, Max? We got carried away, Newt, that's all. Last summer, Max had shared his house with a family of shearwaters, a much fleeter version of a puffin. They colonized the cliffs, looking over the Atlantic, nesting in the rocks. But due to a population explosion, shearwaters had begun to nest in the houses of North Point. They'd chip away at the gyprock exterior, tugging loose styrofoam and pink insulation to make room for their nests. A family of shearwaters made one above Max's bedroom window. In the morning, he'd crane his neck and see the daddy shearwater poke his head out of the hole he'd chipped in the house's facade, darting it in both directions before arrowing out over the water to hunt. Max's father, however, wasn't impressed. The lawn was covered in styrofoam and pink rags of insulation. The birds would wreck the home's resale value, he griped, despite the fact that he'd lived in North Point his whole life and would likely die in this house. He drove to the home hardware, returning with a bottle of insulating foam sealant. He clambered up a ladder to the nest, shooed the birds away, stuck the nozzle into the hole, and pumped in sealant until it billowed out and hardened to a puffy crust. He climbed back down with a self-satisfied smile. But the shearwaters were back the next day. They'd torn away at the sealant, ripping it off in chunks with their sickle-shaped beaks. Now the lawn was covered in styrofoam, insulation, and sealant. Max's father repeated the procedure, believing the birds would relent. But shearwaters are cousins to homing pigeons. They always come back. I should shoot them, Max's father groused, though he could never do such a thing. Still, he was angry, the particular anger of humans defied by the persistence of nature. He drove back to Home Hardware, returning with another can of sealant and a few feet of heavy-duty chicken wire. Using tin snips, he cut the wire into circles roughly the size of the hole. Clambering up the ladder, he made a layer cake of sorts, a layer of sealant, then chicken wire, sealant, wire, sealant, wire. Okay, birds, he'd said, figure that out. Max returned from school the next day to find a dead shearwater in the bushes. The daddy, he could tell by its dark tail feathers. It lay with its neck twisted at a horrible angle. Its beak was broken, half of it was snapped off. Its eyes were filmy gray, like pewter. It had made a mess, shreds of sealant dotted the lawn. But his father's handiwork held strong. The daddy bird must have broken its neck. Had it become so frustrated, so crazy, that it had flown into the barrier until its neck snapped? When Max's father saw the dead bird, his jaw tightened. He blinked a few times very fast, then quietly said, I just wanted them to find someplace else to live. In the middle of the night, Max had been woken by peeping. The sound was coming from the walls. Max padded into his parents' room. His father rubbed sleep crust from his eyes and followed Max back to his bedroom. When he heard those noises, his face did a strange thing. At 3 o'clock in the morning, Max's dad climbed the ladder. His housecoat flapped in the salt breeze. Using a screwdriver and vice grips, he tore out the sealant and chicken wire, working so maniacally that he nearly fell. By the time he'd ripped it away, the peeps had stopped. He reached deep inside the hole, into a small depression he'd not realized was there. He placed whatever he'd found in the pockets of his housecoat with great reverence. In the kitchen, his face white with shock, he laid them on the table, the mama bird and two baby birds. The mama bird's wing was broken. The babies were small and gray-blue, still slick with the gummy liquid inside their eggs. All three were still. I didn't know, was all Max's dad could say. If I'd known, I'd have never. I got carried away. Max thought of this now in relation to what they'd done to Scoutmaster Tim. They'd gotten carried away, was all. It happened to adults, too. When you got angry and frustrated and scared enough, it was so, so easy to get carried away. I never seen a dead person before, said Newton. My hamster died, Yoda. He got out of his cage and got his neck broke by getting caught in a sliding closet door. He was just a hamster, but man, he died in my hands. His neck hung all funny. I couldn't stop crying. Newton swabbed his wrist across his eyes and fetched a deep sigh. We buried him in a shoebox in the backyard. I made a cross out of popsicle sticks. That's kind of dumb. Geez, don't tell the other guys, huh? They'll rag me a new one.
Max's father had buried the birds in a shoebox, too, lining it with lush coffin velvet.
It's not dumb, Newt. It was the right thing to do, I think.
Yeah?
Newt smiled, but his expression darkened by degrees.
Do you think we could let the Scoutmaster out?
Kent's the only one who knows the lock combination. The boys squinted at the pinpricks of light on the mainland. There appeared to be more than usual. Smaller lights zipped back and forth beneath its awning like phosphorescent ants pouring out of a neon anthill. A remote sense of calm settled over Max, a sense of zen forbearance, even as his body marshaled its remaining strength, as if it knew in advance of his mind that he'd need every ounce of it over the coming hours and days. Distantly, Max wondered if this was how men felt in a war. Even more distantly, he wondered about his parents. In bed, probably, sleeping soundly with no earthly idea what was happening.
Do you really think the boat will show up?
Shut up, Newt. Please. Part 2. Infestation. Lead news item from CNN.com. October 22nd. Falstaff Island quarantined due to biological incident of unknown origin. As of 7:15 a.m., the tiny, 18-square-kilometer island of Falstaff, 3 miles off the northern coast of Prince Edward Island, has been officially quarantined. A memo released by the military attaché office cites the cause as a biological incident of unknown origin. This could mean an outbreak of contagious disease, fungal infection, parasite, or a water or airborne contaminant that poses a significant risk to human and animal populations. The military continues to mass in the small town of North Point. Sources indicate the military is working jointly with the Public Health Agency, specifically the Center for Contagious Disease. As yet, no information has surfaced regarding either the specific cause behind the quarantine or the nature of the biological threat. According to the military, the island is currently unoccupied. Chapter 17. They had locked him in the closet. Their scoutmaster. The town's only doctor. Almost unbelievably, this had happened. They'd ganged up. Kent and Ephraim and Shelley, with his ball-bearing eyes. Even Newton and Max had joined in.
You deserved it, Tim, Hal 9000 chastised. You put the boys in danger, knowingly or not, but they were your responsibility. Remember the scout code.
How was it my fault? Tim asked himself. Had he invited the sick man onto the island? Had he purposely, maliciously set events on an extinction vector? No, no. He'd acted out of kindness. He'd done what any caring person would do. He'd tried so hard, under such desperate circumstances, to make the right choices. How was he to know it would turn out so horribly wrong? It ended in this. Tim locked in a closet alone with his thoughts and his hunger and the sick, sweet stink of his body. He was resigned to the fact he'd forever be known as the scoutmaster who'd been mutinied by his own scouts. That ought to make Big Jeff Jenks bust a gut. Tim sat with his spine flushed to the closet wall and his knees drawn tight to his chest. He tested each joint for weak spots. No luck. Solid wood nailed at inflexible angles. A thin bar of sunlight wept under the door. Tim ran his fingers along the dissolving edge of light. Hugely comforting. A link to the world outside the closet, to the mainland and the sureties it held. To his cold cellar and its shelves stocked with preserves, to the glass canister of tongue depressors in his examination room. He breathed heavily and focused. He could untwist a coat hanger and thread it under the door and, what, jab someone in the ankle? Trip one of the boys? Why bother? Maybe he deserved to be here.
There's no maybe about it, Tim, said Hal 9000.
He was trapped, impossibly, inescapably.
Maybe it was for the best. Fact, he was ill. The boys may have been right to lock him up. It hurt tremendously that they'd done it, a sudden feral act that made a mockery of all those years they'd been together, a close-knit group under his command. And now, cooped up in here, he couldn't help them anymore. And that scared him profoundly.
Were you helping them, Tim? Really?
Shut up, Hal, he croaked, sounding like a drain pipe clogged with sludge. You're not my pal, Hal.
You're becoming irrational, Tim. This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Good. Scram. Get lost.
Tim's thoughts returned to his scouts. They were running wild, a quintet of lost boys. Did they have any inkling of the peril they were in? How could they, really? Boys didn't process fear the same way as adults, especially when it came to sickness. Their scabs healed like magic, their coughs dried up overnight. But Tim knew the frailty of human bodies. He'd seen how even the stoutest ones could collapse into a sucking pit of disease and death. Not to mention the fact they'd also laid their hands all over him while doing the deed. They had breathed in the air he'd exhaled in fear-sick gusts. He may have even spit at them. Dear God, had he actually spat on the boys? Part of him, a shockingly large part, was okay being in here. Perhaps he was unfit for command. Fact, he was paralyzed with hunger. He kept catching whiffs of cotton candy from someplace. His eyes blinked uncontrollably. He kept hearing his mother, dead 6 years now, calling him home for supper.
Timmy, chowder's ready.
Eat, said this funny little voice. It wasn't Hal or the undervoice. This one was different, sly and insistent, like baby rats clawing the insides of his head. But there's nothing to eat in here, he told the voice.
Sure there is. There's always things to eat, silly.
The rats kept clawing, clawing. Before long, they'd claw through the soft meat of his brains and scratch through the bone of his skull. Tim pictured it, his skull bulging, his scalp and hair stirring with antic life, the skin splitting with the sound of rotten upholstery as a tide of hairless pink ratlings spilled from the slit, slick with blood and grayish brain curds squealing shrilly as they sheeted clumsily down his face, past his unblinking eyes, bumping and squalling over his lips spread in a vacant smile.
Okay, he answered that funny, niggling voice. But what should I eat?
Oh, eat anything, it said with cold reasonableness. Any old thing you can find.
The closet was wallpapered. Who the hell wallpapered a closet? The paper was torn in flimsy tatters. He tweezed a curl between his fingers. It ripped down the wall with a lovely zippering sound. He placed the strip of wallpaper on his tongue. The ancient paste was vaguely sweet. He swallowed hungrily.
Lovely, the voice said. Just lovely. Now eat more.
Tim did as the voice asked, peeling and eating and peeling and eating. The funny little voice was easy to obey. It didn't ask for much, and what it did request was simple to accomplish.
Just eat and eat and eat.
A body settled on the other side of the door. Tim licked his paper-cut lips. His tongue had gone thick and gluey with paste. He whispered,
Max, is that you?
Silence.
Newt? Ephraim?
A song, sung in a low, mocking warble.
Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. I'm going to the garden to eat worms, big, fat, juicy ones, long, thin, slimy ones, itsy, bitsy, crawly, wally worms.
The singer was plugging up the space between the door and the floor.
Shelley?
Tim's precious bar of light vanished in heart-stopping chunks.
No, he moaned. What are you doing? No, please, no, please, don't.
He pushed his fingers under the door to dislodge the barrier, but his fingertips met with resistance. Next came the honking sound of duct tape stripped off a roll. The last meager particles of light filching under the door disappeared entirely. Tim sat in total darkness. He opened his mouth to beg for his light back. It was all he had, for God's sake. The childlike plea died on his lips. Somewhere down inside of him, not too far down either, he could feel that relentless squirming. His teeth snapped shut. Eat. The voice wasn't so small or funny anymore. Tim did as it said. He wept softly without realizing. Chapter 18. Shelley placed the tape back in the kitchen drawer. His heart was beating a little heavier than normal. His eyes were hot and watery with dull excitement. The scoutmaster was making faint pleading noises from inside the closet. Shelley tried very hard not to laugh. He did not think the scoutmaster's noises were very funny. Shelley didn't find anything funny, really. Not ever. He inhaled through the alcohol-soaked gauze over his mouth and nose. He understood the danger. He could practically see the microscopic eggs ringing the scotch bottle's rim, the one Kent had drunk from last night. He saw the eggs hovering in the cool air above the dead man's chest. This didn't scare him. If anything, it excited him. He glanced at his handiwork on the closet door. He'd wedged two dish towels underneath and taped them in place. Now the scoutmaster had no light at all. If the other boys asked why he did it, he already had an excuse. Shelley had heard the scoutmaster's consumptive hacking and sealed him in so they wouldn't all get what Tim clearly had. Shelley opened the cabin door and slipped quietly outside. A fine band of golden light striped across the horizon. The others still slept round the fire. He went round the side of the cabin and found a spider web suspended between the east-facing wall and the overhang. An intricate hexagonal threadwork hung with beads of morning dew. Shelley plucked a strand of gossamer near the web's center as if he were strumming the world's most fragile guitar. A spider crawled out of a knothole in the log. Its legs pushed out of the hole as one solid thing, all bundled tight like the ribs of a shut umbrella. To Shelley, it looked like an alien flower coming into bloom. This one was big. Its bell-shaped body was the size of a tic-tac. Its color reminded Shelley of the boiled organ meat his mother fed their dog, Shogun. The spider picked its way nimbly across the web. It had mistaken Shelley's gentle plucking for a trapped insect. Shelley pulled a slender barbecue lighter from his pocket. He always carried one. Once, his teacher, Mr. Finnerty, had caught him burning ants near the bike racks after school. The fat carpenter ants had made weird pop sounds as they exploded, like Shelley's morning bowl of Rice Krispies. Mr. Finnerty confiscated his lighter. He'd given Shelley a frosty, revolted look as if he'd just accidentally stepped on a caterpillar in his slipper. Shelley smiled back complacently. He'd simply bought another lighter. He bought one every few weeks from different stores around town. He also bought mouse traps and ant traps. One time, a shopkeep had remarked, "You must live with the Pied Piper, son, all those mouse traps you buy." That had concerned Shelley a little, and he'd made sure to steer clear of that store. It wasn't wise to establish a pattern. He flicked the igniter. A wavering orange finger spurted from the metallic tip. Shelley worked carefully. It wasn't a matter of savoring it. He'd done this so many times that his heartbeat barely fluctuated. He was simply methodical by nature. He touched flame to the web's topmost edges. The gossamer burnt incredibly fast, like fuses zipping toward a powder keg, trailing orange filaments that left a smoky vapor in the air. The web folded over upon itself like the finest lace.
The spider tried to scurry up its collapsing web, but it was like trying to climb a ladder that was simultaneously ablaze and falling into a sinkhole. Shelley idly wondered if the spider felt any confusion or terror. Did insects even feel emotions? He sort of hoped so, but there was no way to be sure. He set fire to the web's remaining moorings. The web fell like a silken parachute with the spider trapped inside. Shelley harassed the spider through the grass, nipping it with the flame. He liked it best when he could sizzle a few legs off or melt their exoskeletons so some of their insides leaked out. He tried not to kill them. He preferred to alter them. It was more interesting. The game lasted longer. He harried the spider until it scuttled under the cabin. He exhaled deeply and blinked his heavy-lidded eyes. Soon the spider would crawl back to its hole and build another web. Spiders were very predictable. When it did, Shelley might return and do it all over again. Shelley scuffed his feet over the charred grass. It was best to leave no evidence. Take only photos, leave only footprints. He worked carefully, reflecting on the fact that this, what he'd just started with the Scoutmaster, was something new entirely. Something terribly exciting. Spiders couldn't tattle on you. Mice couldn't squeal. Well, they could. But now Tim, he might just tell the boys what Shelley had done. But Shelley had an innate sense of leverage, a sixth sense he must have been born with. He understood that people in compromised positions were less believable. And even if the boys did believe Tim, or only a few of them, Max might. Newt definitely would. Well, Shelley wasn't sure that mattered now. He felt the pull of the island in his bones, a strong current anchoring him to it. The sun crawled over the water, and Shelley felt this day, which had only begun, might go on forever. The boys had not yet stirred. When they did, talk would turn to tiresome matters, when the boat would show up, how badly their folks would flip out, the identity of the dead man in the cabin. Most of all, they'd talk about how they'd be safe, real soon. But Shelley was positive the boat wasn't coming. Shelley wasn't particularly intelligent, at least according to the methods society had developed to measure that. He'd scored low on his IQ test. In school, he'd earned C's and the odd D. His teachers gazed upon his pockmarked cheeks and slug gray eyes and pictured Shelley 15 years later in a pair of grease-spotted overalls, his slack and pallid moon face staring up from the oil change pit at a Mr. Lube. Shelley was aware of their opinions, but it didn't trouble him. Shelley was actually happy with this perception. It made it easier to engage in the behaviors that gave him pleasure, though he failed to experience pleasure in the way others did. Shelley was far more perceptive than most gave him credit for. His impassive face was the perfect disguise. His expression hadn't changed when he'd seen the dead man on the Chesterfield, but his practical mind had immediately aligned it with the black helicopter that had hovered overhead during the hike. He had also aligned the thick white rope that had come out of the dead man with the thin white rope that had come out of his dog's bum a few years ago. Shogun, the family Sheltie, had gotten into some spoiled chuck in a neighbor's trash can. He passed a 7-foot worm weeks later. Shelley was home alone when it happened. He heard Shogun howling in the backyard. He found the dog squatted in the zinnias. A white tube was spooling out of his butt, some of it already coiled up in the cocoa shells his father had spread over the flower beds. Shelley crouched down, completely fascinated. He flicked at the white tube, mesmerized. The thing wriggled at his touch. Shelley giggled. He flicked it again. Shogun reared and snapped at him. Shelley waited, then touched the tube again, flicking and flicking it gently with one finger. It was slick with the dog's digestive juices. Shogun mewled pitifully and craned his skull over his haunches to stare at Shelley with wounded, rheumy eyes. After shitting it out, Shogun tried to bury the worm. Shelley shooed the dog aside. He wanted to study it. It was dying very fast. Its head was a flat spoon shape. Many smaller spoon shapes branched off the biggest spoon. It looked like a Venus flytrap. the only plant Shelley found even remotely interesting. Each of the spoons had a slit down the middle studded with tiny, translucent spikes. That must have been how it had moored to the dog's intestines. Fascinating. Shelley thought back to that sunny afternoon in the garden, Shogun's plaintive yipping as that greedy tube spooled out of its bottom. He was filled with a certainty.